Greek life is a cornerstone of the American college experience. Each year, nearly 750,000 students pledge fraternities and sororities. And whether or not you've joined one yourself, you've probably heard about hazing. It's become deeply embedded in campus culture, depicted in countless films and TV shows as a rite of passage. According to the most comprehensive study to date, 73% of students in Greek life experience some form of hazing. So, where did it all begin? The roots of hazing go much deeper than you might think, stretching all the way back to colonial America. And much of what we know about that history comes from one man, Hank Neuer. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, Hank Neuer and the weed in the garden of academe.
I had gotten classic comic books about Frank Buck. He was a bring 'em back alive explorer and adventurer who stocked the zoos with what he had.
That's Hank Neuer. As a kid, Hank was captivated by the Frank Buck comic series, which chronicled the real-life adventures of an animal collector. Buck was famous for bringing exotic animals, everything from snakes to elephants, back to the United States. Hank became an avid reader of the series and was fascinated by the natural world. So, one day, on a visit to the local library looking for more Frank Buck-type books, he came across a title that caught his eye, The Jungle.
So I wanted the Frank Buck. I said, oh, The Jungle. Great. I check it out.
Upton Sinclair's The Jungle is a harrowing expose of life inside Chicago's meatpacking industry, an unflinching look at poverty and the dangerous conditions faced by immigrant workers. Not exactly reading material for a 13-year-old. But Hank was hooked.
I started reading and I couldn't stop reading. I still remember the page with the workman falling into the lard and his body being processed.
Hank is describing a scene where a factory worker accidentally falls into a rendering vat and is ground alive into animal product. As you might imagine, scenes like that grabbed the public's attention. Ultimately, Sinclair's vivid writing helped spark much-needed reforms in the meatpacking industry. But for Hank, it revealed something even bigger: the power of journalism to drive real change. That realization sent him on a path, not to cover working conditions, but something else entirely. Years later, while writing for the student paper at the University of Nevada, Reno, Hank had a chance encounter that changed everything. It happened at a bar near campus called the Little Waldorf.
It was kind of a hangout for a group called the Sundowners, which didn't use the term fraternity, but they were. They had a horrific initiation.
When he arrived, it was clear that pledging season for the Sundowners was in full swing.
I wanted to sit at a booth. There's a booth next to the pool table.
But before he could sit down, Hank spotted something alarming under the pool table. A young man, a Sundowner pledge, lying unresponsive and foaming at the mouth.
I don't even know if I sat. I just looked and saw this and was horrified that, a lot of bubbling like you would think a rabid dog would have.
Hank was shocked. He quickly alerted some of the less intoxicated Sundowners who took the young man home to rest. But nobody, including Hank, thought to call the police or an ambulance. A decision that Hank regrets to this day. Thankfully, as far as Hank knows, the young man survived. But the incident still stuck with him. It felt like it would only be a matter of time before hazing led to tragedy. And that fear became real a year or two later, when Hank learned about John Davies, a pledge with the Sundowners who died during an initiation ritual. The news brought Hank back to the jungle, to the power of one story to expose injustice. And it was then that Hank began to dig into the hidden world of hazing.
When I started to actually do more research, that I said, this may be common, it may be bizarre, and it is, but it's not abnormal. This is a normal part of college.
Hank wasn't shocked to see how widespread hazing was. He'd been through it himself when he pledged a fraternity in college. But what did surprise him was how dangerous it was. Back in the mid-70s, hazing didn't have the same stigma or dangerous reputation it carries today.
There was support of hazing in a large way. It builds character. It prepares people for life later. It teaches arrogant freshmen, as they would say, to be in their place.
Hazing was widely accepted as a rite of passage, viewed through the lens of tradition and camaraderie. But as Hank dug into his research, a more disturbing picture came into focus.
These were not accidental deaths. Because the activities were planned in advance, it needed to be looked at as possible homicides, that law enforcement was lacking in some of the cases.
Hank was uncovering a reality that we understand all too well today, that hazing can be deadly. After a year of painstaking research, he compiled a chilling list of students who had lost their lives during hazing rituals. He published that list in a groundbreaking article titled "The Dead Souls of Hell Week."
They included a young man who'd been buried alive, William Flowers, a young man named Richard Fuse, who died with a terrible amount of alcohol in New Jersey, and then Mortimer Leggett, the first fraternity pledge to die in 1873.
When The Dead Souls of Hell Week was first published, the response was lukewarm. Many academics brushed it off, arguing that while hazing existed, it wasn't serious enough to justify deeper investigation. But the list of deaths just kept growing. In 1978, Hank released the first independent edition of what would become his hazing database, a meticulous record of confirmed hazing-related fatalities. That work eventually reached Eileen Stevens, a mother from New York who had just begun her own battle against hazing. Her son, Chuck Stenzel, had recently died during a brutal fraternity initiation.
I met Eileen early in 1979. She wrote me in October 78 after my database came out, and she said that she had done a New York Times list and could add a few to mine. And so that became this running total.
At that point, Hank had been researching hazing for about 3 years.
I went out to visit her, and we had a lunch that lasted all afternoon, talking, going over things.
They spoke about Eileen's son, Chuck. She was convinced there was more to his death than what she'd been told. The conversation stayed with Hank. He kept in touch with Eileen and eventually decided to take a closer look at what really happened to Chuck at Alfred University.
I spent an extensive amount of time, might have been 10 days, at the library going through things, and a second trip back to do interviews. I was on the phone and doing interviews with a lot of the young people.
What Hank uncovered through his interviews and research was so revealing that it became the foundation for his book, Broken Pledges. In the preface, he includes a quote from Chuck's memorial service, a passage from John 8:7. "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." Hank goes on to write, "I am not without sin. I pledged Sigma Tau Rho and was initiated in 1965. I was hazed as a pledge. I hazed as a member. But the problem of hazing is too demeaning, dangerous, and widespread for even sinners like myself to ignore. It shatters the lives of perpetrators as well as those of victims and their families. I concluded finally that a former sinner might be the best qualified to expose hazing abuses. I hereby cast the first stone." Hank Neuer's book, Broken Pledges, was the culmination of years of research. It weaves together the broader history of hazing with the deeply personal story of Chuck Stenzel and the events that led to his death.
So I pieced together Chuck interviewing a former girlfriend at Doan College. I interviewed his best friends from Long Island. Chuck was going to be a history teacher. I got his term papers, including one on Kurt Vonnegut that I still have back at home. on the symbol of blackness in Slaughterhouse-Five. He was a fairly good writer, good researcher. I have no doubt he would have been a heck of a history teacher if that's what he really wanted to be after he came out. That was a lot of legwork here to put together who was Chuck in an accurate way.
So what did Hank ultimately discover? To understand that, we need to revisit the night of Chuck's death. It was a cold February evening in 1978 at Alfred University. Chuck Stenzel was in his dorm room, anxiously awaiting a visitor. This visitor was set to bring news from Clan Alpine, a social fraternity at Alfred. It was a defining moment for Chuck. It was tapping night, the official kickoff of pledge season. Chuck was about to discover whether he'd been invited to join Clan Alpine, an opportunity that would immediately immerse him in the duties and rituals of a new pledge. He was instructed to wait in his room after dinner. Just after 7 p.m., there was a knock on the door. Opening it, Chuck was met by a somber-looking brother who delivered disheartening news. "I'm sorry, the membership voted and some of the brothers thought you wouldn't be a good fit." With those words, the brother departed, leaving Chuck to sulk in his room. But just a few minutes later, the brother returned. It was just a joke, and they wanted him after all. He presented Chuck with a gray shirt featuring Clan in bold black letters. Now donning his new fraternity shirt, Chuck stepped out into the brisk night. The ground was thick with nearly 2 feet of snow, but the roads were just clear enough for travel, and the celebration headed towards the fraternity house. But there was a catch. Chuck had to ride in the trunk of the car. Soon, two other pledges were crammed into the trunk with Chuck.
Chuck was locked in a trunk with a six-pack, some wine, some hard alcohol.
The three pledges were told that they couldn't leave the trunk until they'd finished all the alcohol.
Chuck, in that pledge class, was kind of the father rooster to these others and protective, because he then took over for some pledges in that trunk and consumed theirs as well.
It took 45 minutes for Chuck and the other pledges to finish the alcohol while locked in the trunk of an old blue Chevrolet. Then they were ushered inside the fraternity house and led to a table laden with glasses of wine, a part of a decades-old Clan Alpine tradition. Chuck quickly downed two glasses. Next, it was time for a series of traditional Clan Alpine games, collectively known as the races. One of the games required the pledges to race each other in chugging a cup of beer. Clan brothers participated as well, but they often tossed their beer over their shoulders, only pretending to drink while claiming victory.
They told Chuck the theme of today's party is don't stop till you drop. They decided to play a stupid game that they played every tapping night, which is the brothers chugged water that looked like vodka while the pledges chugged vodka. Stupid and deadly, and nobody's keeping track.
The goal of the drinking game and other games played that night was to fill a trash can to the top with vomit. As the night wore on, Chuck's speech grew slurred. He was mumbling, barely coherent. By the end of the party, he was soaked in beer and barely conscious. His big brother in the fraternity, Rocky LaForge, and another Klan member tried to help. They gave him a shower and laid him down to rest.
He was to be put to sleep. Unfortunately, Rocky, after giving him a shower, went to take a shower himself.
Rocky got out of the shower around 11:30 p.m. to find Chuck barely breathing. The skin under his fingernails had turned blue.
And in that amount of time, Chuck passed, and they could not resuscitate him.
None of the brothers knew CPR, and few were sober enough to take much action. They called 911, and Chuck was treated by EMTs until he was pronounced dead at 1:45 a.m.
The members could not believe that alcohol alone could kill, and they were looking to see if he had taken any barbiturates or anything else. And that was the first information they gave to the rescuers. They didn't know if they had a drug death, an alcohol death. There was confusion.
And it turns out that there was nearly another death that night. When authorities tried to account for all members and pledges, there was one pledge nobody could find. Finally, after forcing open a locked closet door, the pledge was found unconscious with a faint heartbeat. Chuck's mother, Eileen Stevens, received a phone call from the university in the middle of the night. She rushed to campus and arrived early the next morning. When Chuck's body was examined, the autopsy revealed a blood alcohol content of 0.46. Anything above 0.40 is considered lethal without immediate medical attention.
The pathologist said to her that he considered it a homicide or murder.
More specifically, the coroner told Eileen that the cause of death was diffuse pulmonary edema caused by acute alcohol poisoning. In layman's terms, his organs had drowned in alcohol. Eileen insisted that she be allowed to see her son one last time. The coroner, hospital staff, nurses, and others tried to dissuade her. But ultimately, she was led to the morgue. Shivering in the cold room, Eileen took Chuck's hand and whispered, "I love you, Chuck." She kissed him and said a prayer, while the nearby nurse broke down in tears. In the weeks and months after Chuck's death, the police investigation stalled. In the end, no one was charged, and the incident was written off as a tragic accident. But years later, as Hank researched the case, a very different picture began to emerge.
I go to the hospital to get his records. They readily went in. The file had disappeared.
Chuck's entire case file from the night of his death had vanished. It hadn't just been misplaced. It was gone. Crucial evidence was missing, and it became clear that someone had gone to great lengths to keep the full story buried.
I talked with the ailing, elderly coroner who told me George Francis had forbidden him to release public information about Chuck.
George Francis was the district attorney in Alfred at the time of Chuck's death. According to the coroner, the DA had personally prohibited the release of information related to the case. So, Hank made a trip to Buffalo to speak with Francis, who was then a New York State judge.
It was a blustery day, I'll never forget it. Windows were being blown out downtown when I went in. I got an answer from his secretary, and then he had already called the police. And I had a choice of leaving or be arrested. I've never been arrested. I don't want to be arrested. So I left quietly. And then he refused all my phone calls ever after. And when I went back to Alfred yet again and went over, the present district attorney couldn't believe it. Chuck Stenzel's file had disappeared. It doesn't exist.
Meaning both the hospital file and the district attorney's file had been hidden or destroyed. Campus Files producer Ian Mont asked Hank about that.
What would be the motivation for making those files disappear?
Alfred is a special place in terms of a lot of the graduates, the students, the beauty of the campus. It's also small town America and very political. And it is the employment and was then in 1978 for a lot of people. I feel he covered up.
To protect the institution, not the fraternity, but the college itself.
I think to protect his shitty investigation. You can quote me.
The circumstances surrounding Chuck Stenzel's death and what followed weren't isolated. They were part of a troubling pattern that Hank was beginning to uncover. A pattern where hazing isn't met with accountability, but with cover-ups. Where administrators and police protect reputations instead of confronting the truth. And in doing so, they allowed dangerous hazing rituals to not only continue, but to escalate. And that's exactly what happened at Alfred University. In 2002, a student came forward and reported his fraternity for hazing. Not long after, he was beaten to death. June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples: breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
After years of research, Hank had pieced together a sweeping history of Greek life in America, one that reveals just how deeply rooted the tradition really is.
Well, first of all, it got into the American educational system. In colonial Yale, for example, you had faculty coming in from England with servitude, having a younger person kowtow to you, and there was a lot of abuse there. That came to the country and was seen kind of a positive thing when these scholars would come over. So it was inculcated in a lot of schools.
Hank describes how hazing first took root on American soil, how elite schools like Yale and Harvard, models for many other institutions across the country, imported traditions from colonial England, including rituals rooted in servitude and hierarchy. While these early practices weren't as physically brutal as the hazing that we often see today, they were just as deeply woven into campus life. A 1913 book called The Story of Harvard lists just a few of the rules that freshmen were expected to follow back in the mid-1700s. No freshman shall speak to a senior with his hat on. All freshmen shall be obliged to go on errands for any of their seniors, graduates, or undergraduates at any time. When any person knocks at a freshman's door, he shall immediately open the door without inquiring who is there. These rules, enforced at Harvard until 1798, weren't overtly violent, but they reflected early traditions of subservience and control. And it was those very traditions that laid the groundwork for the more extreme and dangerous hazing practices that would follow. Over time, the cultural norms behind them hardened, spreading across campuses and becoming deeply embedded in American higher education. Then, in 1838, hazing turned deadly. John Butler Groves became the first known student to die in a hazing incident on a U.S. campus. About 40 years later came the first hazing death tied to a fraternity. At Cornell, a student named Mortimer Leggett fell into a gorge while blindfolded during a pledge ritual. He'd been rushing the Kappa Alpha Society, an organization that's still active today and often credited as the birthplace of American fraternity life. 2 decades and 4 hazing deaths later, in 1899, another Cornell student, also a Kappa Alpha pledge, drowned during a hazing event. That, Hank says, was the point of no return.
The death would have been about 1899, was almost the same circumstances as the 1873 death. Kappa Alpha Society, same group, same school. And in both cases, they were found not guilty. All the history of hazing could have changed if in those 2 cases, somebody went to jail immediately. It would have put some fear into the universities and into fraternity members at that time. And you have to understand that fraternities then, right into the 1928s, were covered on the front pages of the New York Times. These were political groups then.
From that point on, hazing deaths began to accelerate, 3 in 1900 and 23 by 1910. In a late 19th century speech at Harvard, hazing was famously called a weed in the garden of academe, a practice that had existed since the days of Plato in ancient Greece, and one the speaker claimed could never truly be eradicated. And in the decades that followed, that weed just kept growing, especially in the 1970s, when states began raising the legal drinking age to 21.
Look at the period when alcohol, the age of consumption, went from 18 to 21. When you look at my database, you'll see those numbers shooting up. After the drinking age, it became attractive. It became a symbol of rebellion.
As drinking moved behind closed doors, it became even more dangerous. It was under these conditions that John Davies died with the Sundowners and Chuck Stenzel with Clan Alpine. While the number of hazing deaths varied year to year, the U.S. recorded at least one hazing-related fatality every single year from 1959 through 2021. That deadly streak lasted 62 years and claimed 214 lives. It took a global pandemic and the closure of campuses nationwide to finally break the pattern. But once COVID lockdowns lifted, hazing came roaring back. In 2023 alone, 4 students died, 3 in an alcohol-fueled car crash, and 1 by suicide linked to hazing. As to why hazing persists despite these tragedies, Hank has a few theories.
Hazing is so attractive because for young people, it serves as a lark, number one. Number two, it's disapproved of by their elders. And number three, students, all of us, want to go through a kind of liminal space. Before this, I wasn't in. I wasn't this. After I went through this, I was here. And that's why it's such a psychological problem when students are blackballed or drop out right before they get into the group. You'll see a correlation of actually dropping out of school.
As of today, Hank Neuer has documented 303 hazing-related deaths at colleges across the United States. His decades-long research has fundamentally reshaped our understanding of hazing, its origins, its persistence, and its tragic consequences. Hank's writings have been cited nearly 1,000 times in academic studies on hazing, an area of scholarship that barely existed before his groundbreaking article appeared in Human Behavior. His tireless work has also supported Eileen Stevens and countless other families as they've pushed for legislative action against hazing. At the time of Chuck's death, only 5 states had laws addressing hazing. Today, that number has risen to 44. And in December 2024, the Biden administration signed into law the first ever federal anti-hazing legislation.
This is a social organization. The fun time is important, particularly when you're at a school where you can be lost. But no one should die for a good time, number one. And number two, the old line about you are your brother's keeper is important. You can't be desensitized. You just can't be. Like, for example, I told you about the death at Nevada, Reno. If I could go back, I would have called 911. Yes, maybe they would have been punished. Yes, I would have lost acquaintances that I called friends back then. But maybe John Davies would be alive.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.